Here's a good question to begin with. Having made some headway with the non-attachment to particulars, I am now somewhat confused with integrating the instruction to say yes or no very definitely in any situation. If this is done, is there not great danger because of having to defend the yes or no and thus to shift into attachment? There's another part to this question. I'd better deal with the first part first. Headway has been made with non-attachment. And now we have to find out how to say yes or no very definitely in any situation. Non-attachment means that you have been attached already, and will let a circle represent the object to which you have been attached. And to become non-attached is first to become aware of that object with which you are attached, and then to break away from it. Now, after practicing this for some time, you discover that you're continuously represented with other situations, other objects, in time, and you are to practice saying yes or no. And no in between is allowed. We're not allowed to say maybe in a given situation, because saying maybe does not commit us to action. And if we pursue maybe all our lives, we will find that we're not growing at all. This is the New Testament Laodicean naughty behavior of not blowing hot, not blowing cold. Wherefore the Lord will spew such beings out of the mouth. We said that in order to say yes or no to a situation, we must first be very clear about the elements in the situation, because if the situation has more than one element, it is possible for you to say yes and no simultaneously. Yes to one element and no to the other. When we were using the symbol of attachism, this is TX, and we said if you move towards it, we would call it a positive attachism, and if away from it, we would call it a negative attachism. We can see that there will be a positive attachism in a perfectly simple situation where the element can be assimilated by a being. If the being can assimilate the element, then it will be positive towards it. It will posit this element inside itself. This is true if the element is simple. By simple, we will mean here that it has no parts. So if we get somebody predisposed to eat sweets, and we find the sweet, and the kind that person likes, just one, and give it to that person, for the sake of the argument at the moment, we could pretend that that sweet is a simple. We'll ignore its molecular structure and pretend it is just one simple sweet element, which that sweet lover will then be positive towards. Now, if we then wrap the thing up in silver paper, we have introduced something into it that is not sweet and not assimilable. And the situation has immediately become complex. So if we say we are positively toxic towards the sweet, we will say we are negatively toxic towards the foil wrapping. The situation will therefore have to be analysed, or we'll have to take the wrapping paper off the sweet. If we apply this method in every situation, we must analyse the situation down into its simple elements. Now sometimes you find sweets wrapped up not in lead foil, but in rice paper, made of rice. That is, it's an edible wrapping paper. So you won't be quite so negatively toxic towards that paper as you would be if it were made of lead. Now, it might have stuck to the sweet, so that it would be difficult to take it off. And the amount of energy involved in taking it off might be more than you would be prepared to expend to get at the sweet. So that you'll be prepared to swallow the non-sweet rice paper rather than expend the energy to take it off and get at the sweet within. So we can recognize degrees of intensity of the positive and the negative elements in a situation. A man may be very fond of a beautiful girl's beautiful head and discover that she has flat feet. Now, when he discovers this, he will be negatively toxic towards her low arches and positively toxic towards her Greek features. And he must decide then whether he can actually amputate the arches and take the Greek head, or whether he will settle for a compromise. Now, in every real life situation, there will be some elements to which you are positively toxic and some to which you are not. But you must be very, very clear about this. You mustn't deceive yourself. If you are definitely negatively toxic to fallen arches, you should say so. You shouldn't pretend that you're really fond of them. Because if you do, you'll be telling lies to yourself. And later on, you will find occasion to say, when she gets a few crow's feet round the eyes, "I never did like your arches." These things seem very, very simple. But in fact, in real life situations, every situation is not simple. And therefore, you cannot get to a total situation an unqualified yes or no. So you have to break down the situation into its constituent elements and say clearly to yourself what elements you can give an unqualified yes to, what elements you can give an unqualified no to, and then add them up. And if there are more yeses than there are no's, then consciously submit and accept the no's for the sake of the yeses. If you do this, you won't feel any worse than a person does who parts with threepence or a packet of mint with a hole in it. Because you will be aware that you have paid for something. Now, everybody's negatively toxic towards paying and positively toxic towards enjoying. But if you consider very carefully the nature of the universe as a modality of force and that there is nothing else, you will realize that there is nothing for nothing. That is to say, there will always be paying of some kind as long as there is acquiring of some kind. So you will evaluate the situation in terms of benefits to be received and payments to be made. When you do this with a situation, you will find that you can, after careful analysis, affirm a situation which has many negative elements in it. Let's take a most obvious one of world-shaking proportions, the crucifixion of Christ. He steadfastly set his face towards Jerusalem. That is, he didn't run away, he went towards crucifixion. And he was a man, being Yiddish, who talked a lot about profit. He said, "What should it profit you if you gain the whole world and lose your soul?" He was talking about profit. So that when he went towards crucifixion, instead of away from it, he must have seen a bigger profit than the loss he was about to suffer. When he realized, made real to himself, the implications of his own consciousness, he saw that unless some person were to demonstrate how to affirm a negative, that is, how to make the negative positive, then the whole of humanity would persist in trying to dodge the negatives and pursue the positives. That is, it would avoid the pains and pursue the pleasures. Now, the attempt to avoid pains and pursue pleasures completely, perfectly, is doomed to failure because the world is necessarily paradoxical. It is a world made of opposites. It is impossible to get a situation which is not, in the very act of being profitable, not profitable. Let's take an example. The concept of ananda in Buddhism is the concept of bliss. The word ananda is made up of this an word and implies a serpent running along. It is undulating, it is going, it is willing to go. It is not going to any place yet because there aren't any places. It is just ceaselessly translating, and its will is simply to move. And therefore, as its will is simply to move, it is fulfilling its will. And when the will is continuously fulfilling itself without opposition, then the psychological state of that being is bliss. So we say that bliss arises when the will fulfills itself perfectly without interruption. When that is going along, fulfilling itself, it can propagate infinitely and eternally and remain in that state of bliss. But while it's going about, it has no reason to go in any particular way, and in its continuous moving, it is actually avoiding closure. You can see if I keep on doing this in infinite space, I need never close. And therefore, I need never face a certain kind of problem which arises in the closed state. Let this meandering form represent that bliss. It is simply the will moving along without any opposition whatever, and it is enjoying its own motion. As somebody said a considerable number of years after this process first started, it is better to journey than to arrive. Now, the person who likes to journey without arriving is called a non-teleological person. He doesn't care if he has no end. We find that this concept of the journeying without arriving is very oriental. And because the world is paradoxical, there must be an occidental opposite to it. If we get the concept of journeying without arriving, we must generate the concept of journeying with arriving. And as soon as we think of arriving, we will have to close at some point. You see, as soon as we've done this, we start to rotate. And in this act of rotating, we have arrived. Now the arrive, the R-I-V-E, like the riven and driven and so on, implies division, separation of a zone from this infinite propagation. Now the will, travelling infinitely and never closing itself, just enjoys blissful motion, but it has no object at all. It's just like a perpetual pipe dream, something like an overdose of opium. When we close the energy, we find something that did not previously exist. This energy, translating, now rotates. And in the act of rotating, it brings to be. Remember, the letter B used to be written as a circle. And this circle was divided, made into two semicircles, and became our letter B. B is circumscription. So it comes to be. Now, when it comes to be, it discovers a possibility. It separates the outer and the inner. There's an infinite force translating blissfully outside, and inside it there is a force now constrained by this rotation barrier. Now, if the will did not get anything out of it, if it did not show a profit out of this rotation, it would promptly abandon it. We actually see certain people going along through the park, meandering about it, and then they see something nice, turn around it, have a look at it, and suddenly they see a nasty frown on its face, and so they start translating again and go away. Now, as soon as the situation becomes unprofitable, then the being will tend to go away. So, in order to justify enclosure or restriction or bondage, we have to show a profit. And that profit must be in terms of heightened happiness, heightened joy. Supposing we say this translation without rotation is felt by spirit as bliss, then there must be something better than bliss. Otherwise, that translating spirit would never have bothered to make itself. Let us go inside and see what it gains. When there is pure translation without rotation, then there is no opposition. When there is no opposition, there is no heightened awareness. Imagine an infinite motion is infinitely sensitive. And as a good Yiddish rabbi would say, at both ends. It is so infinitely super sensitive that its infinity goes down to the little end as well as the big end, which is equivalent to feeling precisely nothing. So this peculiar Ananda process is one in which you have no value, because value presupposes circumscription, but the will is infinitely translating, but it is not fulfilling itself, because to fulfill you must feel full, and you can't feel full unless you first make a closure and then fill it. We are concerned with the heightening of happiness in ourselves, with the increase of joy. If in the infinite propagation there is a state which we can loosely call bliss, and yet factually the universe has been brought into being, then it follows that being must contain a value which is not in non-being. When it says God so loved the world, it is a statement that this world, this orderly system, has a value which the Godhead, the translating spirit, non-rotating, must have precipitated because it was worthwhile. So there is something in existence, in bondage, in circumscription, that is not in the simple translation. The only thing it can be is that which arises from opposition. If you relax yourself completely, you will become progressively less and less aware of your body. If the relaxation were total, you would become unconscious. And therefore, by slight contraction, you increase awareness. And this contraction is a contraction of contraction. You must oppose. In order to oppose, you must close. As soon as you have closed the situation, you have heightened your awareness. And you have made at the same moment a self. You can spell it C-E-L-L-F if you want. It's the same word. You have made a cell, and that cell is a force, and that force is intelligent. Now that self, by simply contracting, pulsing, on the impulse, becomes aware that it is a being. And on the expulse, it becomes aware that it might cease to be. If it ceases to be, it will lose this heightened awareness. If it contracts too tightly, it will block itself completely, and its heightened awareness will become hell. So between infinite extension and infinite intention, there is a rotation zone, which rotation zone is the zone of all value. It is this rotation zone that is the zone that we call the zone of action. This translation of force is not technically an action at all. We have to put the KT into action. It is AKT. If we don't get this closure, symbolized by KT, then we may have eon, we may have A, but we haven't got the closure. It is this KT that heightens the self-awareness. When we relax, if we're not careful, we fall asleep. When we've been asleep for a certain length of time, we tend to wake up. When we wake up, we tend to focus on objects and start doing something. We are spirit, intelligent substance, and our behavior is derived from the nature of the absolute. If the absolute does not precipitate zones of closure, then it will not have an object. If it has no object, simply it is objectless. The value in the object is this heightened awareness. When Christ says he has come that we might have life and have it more abundantly, he's saying if we can understand the meaning of bondage or the crucifixion, which is the same concept fundamentally, then we will heighten the value of our life. If we get ourselves under the influence of alcohol or certain drugs, our awareness dies down below a certain level, and we find that it isn't really worth living. Living isn't worth it. It isn't intense enough to make it worthwhile to our consciousness. when we consider the word value, we're considering a word very closely related to volume, volition, a developing force tied results in another force that feels itself. The tying is this ligature, which is the li principle, religium, the li of the Chinese, the principle of ethics or bindingness. First the energy going along must tie itself, and then it can emerge with a power felt simply because it has tied itself. If we can circumscribe ourselves, at the moment of circumscription, we become aware of something that we did not know about previously. So the whole purpose of objectification is heightened awareness. I suppose when we go back to this question for a moment, we see we have to learn how to say yes or no to a situation. But in the time process, every situation contains elements of yes and elements of no, and they cannot be separated out. It isn't fair to amputate the fallen arches. And therefore you have to take the girl as she is. If you are conscious of the fact that you are taking the bad parts of it, because the good parts make it worth your while taking the bad parts, you will never complain about the bad parts. You will just say they are the price that you paid for the good parts. Now, that is not the usual way of making a relationship. The usual way is for you to be fascinated by the nice parts and blinded by them. They're so marvelous, they just radiate at you and put your eyes out of commission. And then you take the whole lot, and then later, when your eyes come back into focus, you have time to see that you've got something that you did not bargain for. The rest of your life tends to be then spent in complaining about the fallen arches that you didn't notice at the time you saw the Greek profile. If this is seen clearly, then all situations can be affirmed positively, and we can make a very, very simple rule out of it. We can say every situation and every person, every relation, necessarily has in it something that we don't like. This applies to all situations. And therefore, whatever situation we go into, we will know beforehand there's something in it that if it were isolated, we would refuse. But because it cannot be isolated, because that is abstract thinking, we must take the situation wholly or reject it wholly. This is the point at issue. If we know that this is so, every situation is full of yeses and noes. But because of this fact, if we look at it and take the whole situation and then concentrate on the yeses and let the noes take care of themselves, we will affirm that situation and in so doing fulfill our will, because we have paid. We said that bliss is the fulfillment of the will by its own motion when it is circumscribed. Prior to circumscription, it is not fulfilled, because it is not filled full. We are short of terms unless we reduce ourselves down to literal significances. This word ananda is usually translated bliss. If we remember that the word anna, repeated, is simply an old drawing of a wave like this, we can leave the D off it for a moment and say anna, 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 repeated indefinitely, means this propagation without closure. When this word ananda, and this da is the same as giving, for which you get datum and so on, when this is translated into the English word bliss, you have a B on the word bliss, and that B implies circumscription. And the list implies escape. The spirit blows when it lists. It tries to get out. The L is the tying part, and the S is the escape from it. So in the word bliss, you imply that you have just managed to avoid rotating. when that snaky form is going along, sometimes it turns back on itself and suddenly realizes it's about to be tired, and it goes out again and keeps dodging it. And this is the process of bliss. But bliss can never develop this opposition which heightens consciousness. If we take the mystical concept of the absolute ocean of light, you know, the light that never was on land nor sea, is the light of the infinite. But that light is not a light which flashes, it is an ineffable light. The kind of light you get in a fluorescent light without any filament in it. Imagine the light of a fluorescent tube. Remove the tube and let the light propagate infinitely and have nothing else in it to cast a shadow. Equate your awareness with that light and you are light with no darkness, and therefore you have no comparison, so that you do not know that you are light. You are being light, but you are not being light, because to say that you are being light is to circumscribe. So we have to use another expression: you are non-being light, and therefore don't know that you are light. In order to know that you are light, you must darken yourself. This darkening process is caused by circumscription. As soon as you make a rotating force, then the undulating force is outside it, beating against it, unable to penetrate it. Call it dark. Dark, derek, actually means this process of interference. You know that you can shine two lights on top of each other and they will produce darkness. Any theatrical lighting man knows that he can make darkness by shining two kinds of light. We can actually make silence by sounding two notes simultaneously. If we make the crests and troughs of these waves coincide, you can make out of two sounds or two lights silence or darkness. This rotating force stops the free translation round it, and the free translating energy now discovers that when it impinges on there, it is bounced off. Suddenly, it cannot go where it wants to go. It can only go where it wants to go, providing it keeps away from that rotating part. That rotating part now has the power to annoy the blissful spirit outside the rotation. So that the first spirit to rotate has imposed within the infinite an irritant. This is the bindu, the dot, the jot, that shall not pass away till all is fulfilled. This is called the great interjection, mystically. This is the logos spermaticos. It is a closed form inserted into infinity, and now it can impose on infinity. The propagating energies coming near it bounce against it, and they're forced to change their direction. And furthermore, this closed one can open itself at its own will for specific purposes, and by so doing make a mouth in itself and snatch the energy from outside and draw it in. And thus it can engulf energy round about it that was previously blissful, but once it is drawn in, it will become ordered by the fact of the rotation. And this rotation will then proceed to expand. Now, every time it opens and snatches at some of this free energy, it grows bigger. And you can then see that any one of these points, once brought into existence, can go on expanding eternally and infinitely and gobble up continuously the free energy which was previously blissfully dodging the opposition and simply fulfilling its will to one, although we shouldn't use the word fulfill. We can then see that this being, which starts as a little mustard seed, has the power, once it's come into existence, to eat up all the surrounding energy, and given infinite time it will eat the lot up. Only it's not a lot, because a lot implies finity. But it can go on eating it, meat ever so long, as the scholastics might say. When we see this, we find that we can induce in the closed system forms and establish them objectively and heighten awareness within this restricted zone in all different ways. Once we've understood that the closure itself, which is a negation, is the key to positivity, to value, then we can affirm all no's. We can turn all the no's into yeses. If we once understand that if a situation is difficult for us and painful for us, and we go into it, we are, in the fact of going into it, converting a negative into a positive and pinching energy from infinity in the process, and therefore growing, and in the act of growing, gaining new pattern possibilities, new types of heightened awareness, and so on, then we can understand what it means. Blessed is he who has gained the victory. Victory itself implies, you can see the Tor in it, that rotation. There is the developing energy, there is a closure, that's the same character as in act, there is the establishment of the law and its final integration. Victory means that you commit yourself to a closed situation, and this closed situation, when ordered and its forms integrated, will constitute a victory, that is, a heightened sense of awareness for the self. Let's go to the second part now. It says here that my life has been ordered by the disastrous results. And then it says, no saying yes and no. Which is apparently there's been an unconscious slip there. And no probably means not. Through not saying yes and no to every situation, I was becoming pleased with some measure of escape from this reaction and just letting anything happen. The word anything is anything happen. This is another unconscious slip which is very instructive. It says that if I allow things to happen, another person will get the advantage out of the situation. And this is a deep, unconscious perception of a truth. When there is a being in existence and there is another being in existence, if one of these beings starts to allow things to happen to it, because of the difficulty of solving the yes-no relationship, then if there is another being who is not allowing things to happen, but is affirming negatives, that is looking for difficult situations and going into them, the one that is affirming these negatives will absorb the other one who is allowing things. The one who is allowing has made himself passive. And when you are passive, you are at the mercy of someone who is active. We said before that if everyone were asleep, it would be safe. But if one man wakes up, then all the sleepers are in danger of what the one man might do to them. So if you allow things to happen to yourself because of a difficulty of resolving the yes-no relationship, you will not be left alone in that allowance. You won't drift about in supreme allowance mood, because you will come up against other people who at varying levels of integration will either join you in the allowance and make an allowance club and then be subjected to some disallowers, or you will come up immediately against disallowers who will start disallowing your allowance. As soon as you become indiscriminate, it won't save you if you call it tolerance. When you are indiscriminate, you are not discriminating. Discriminating means untying the criminated. And the criminated is already a finited situation. This is the same root again. This substantialization of the created. To discrim is already to discreate, to analyze. To indiscriminate discriminate is to fail to analyze the created, in which case you will take the created whole, and without analysis you will get so many no's and so many yeses. And as we've said before, if you do this, later on the no's will annoy you. So if you do allow yourself to become an aligned being, you become passive, you will not be simply in a universe where the other beings will allow you to go on allowing, because there are beings who do not allow mere allowing. They treat allowing beings as substance upon which they will work, clay to model. The word tolerance means something much higher than indiscrimination. The tol in tolerance means Lord, and the essence of the discrimination of the Lord is the meaning of tolerance. As far as an engineer is concerned, if you take a ball race with the bearings inside it, those bearings have a little bit of space between them. That space allows them to run. When they run, the friction expands them a little bit by making heat, and they become slightly bigger. And if they were made to fit exactly when they were not running, then on running, the friction would generate heat that would expand them and the ball race would seize up. The space in between is called tolerance. That is lordship. Now, inside of a person, there are sub-ends. If you squeeze these sub-ends together too closely, when you begin to operate, they will overheat, and then you will seize up, you will block, you will be unable to move. If you apply the same rule with a group of people, where each person has an individual character, and you require the conforming of those to a single plan, and you reduce the distances between them by forcing them into conformity, then again the group will get overheated and seize up. If you can squeeze it even harder when it's seized up, it will incandesce and return back to the light from which it derived. But it requires a lot of pressure to incandesce a whole group. So we must not confuse tolerance with indiscrimination. Tolerance is the conscious allowance, not the passive allowance, the conscious active allowance of space between entities, so that those entities may rotate and display their characters properly. Whereas indiscrimination is simply the not doing of something that should be done, namely becoming aware of the situation. And we have another little problem related to this one, only more particularized, where yes and no are raised again. I'll read through this problem fairly quickly. A is bringing a car to the meeting and has one vacant seat. He asks B to come with him, but B has a friend, C, who will have to come on a bus alone. Immediate reaction, blow C, I want to go in the car, C can look after herself. Considered reaction, no, I will go in the bus because the first reaction was of, blow you Jack, I'm in the lifeboat. Further thoughts, confusion arises because several reactions may be based on condensing, the second reaction may be based on considering what C may think of B if she does go in the car. Shock reaction, should she offer C the seat, but finds she cannot do this because A and C will think she is bombing. How does B get to the meeting? It has been suggested that B walks. Now, all of this arises out of considering rotating beings as finites and ignoring the field. When there is a being, that being is necessarily causing a turbulation in the field. And this is true of all the beings. So if there are three beings together, there is a highly complex situation in the field. You remember that Spinoza said that adequate knowledge makes us active, and inadequate knowledge makes us passive. We are passive to the situation when we cannot solve it, when all the forces in it are not in our consciousness, and therefore we cannot control the situation. To control it, we must know the elements within it. Control, count the roles. Here is A, B, and C. We needn't bother about the bus at the moment. There's all the bus out there. Now, supposing A and B are presented with a situation, and they're about to go away, but A has a relation with C, and B hasn't got that relation with C, so the link factor between B and C is A. A has to make a decision. Supposing A believes that A is finite and is unaware of the field, then it will have to reckon up what to do in terms of particular, that is, isolated effects. It may say, if I go with B, I may antagonize C, and then C later may do me a naughty one back because of this antagonism. At that level, you cannot predict what will happen because you are counting in terms of contingent relations. No matter how carefully you count the contingent relation, you will never be able to solve that three-body relation. But if you become aware of the whole significance of these finites as precipitates of one field, you then seize the initiative. Suppose you may have a two-seater invalid car and somebody can't get in. And B has asked A to go, and A realizes that C, being confined to a finite concept, will be upset if A accepts the invitation and goes with B. If A now feels this process going on inside, now A says, I know that if I affirm a negative, I will gain. Which is going to drag him into the comfort mechanism, and he can feel a definite no in him that says, don't refuse this invitation. So he deliberately says, don't take me, take C. Now he's now passed the ball over to C and B. They must resolve the problem. Now, according to their level of development, they will do something about it. If B is very, very fond of A and doesn't like C, B will feel terrible about it and will have certain turbulence inside, which is the meaning of this turbulence, and he will become wiser while he is contemplating it and reveal his level of character development. If C then thinks, I will accept B's invitation, and B is annoyed because it wants A and not C, then when they go, C will be led to wish it hadn't accepted the invitation. Now, it will be aware of what's called an atmosphere. Now, if C needs this kind of lesson of increased sensitivity through being inside a two-seater invalid car, then it should have that lesson, and it is A's duty, if he is aware of it, to move out of the situation so that B and C can resolve the relationship of enmity between them. It's his high ethical duty to make room on the principle of tolerance so that they can resolve this problem themselves. And notice that if he moves out, which is creating space, relatively he is reducing the space between them. And that is part of the dialectical process. If we took two entities with a certain distance between them, and a third one there, so the distances were equal, and the third one took the initiative and moved away, he would actually and relatively reduce the distance between the other two. And this is a real reduction. It's not a figure of speech, because the field between those two sets will then be in a different state. The being that can move out of the situation, therefore, is driving the other two together, dialectically, in the very moment where he's allowing them space. So to allow space is the same thing as to take it off them. Now you have to be able to perceive these dialectical involvements of relation. It needs courage to do it. The tendency is for a being to say, well, if I give up my seat and let C go, they might appreciate it and give me a chalk bar next week, and they might not. They might get so overheated that they'll both be annoyed with me, and so I'd better go to keep the peace. But if he goes to keep the peace, he's going towards the sugar. He's going towards the pleasure. And you can never develop value unless you go towards the painful. Remember, we've seen that that ananda process is continuously dodging this closure. And in that dodging process is its bliss. It's almost saying to itself, I just escaped that one. It hasn't got a forehead to wipe because it hasn't closed itself. But it has a little shadow of a forehead that it might have when it's dodging. Shortly then we will say that the rule is, if the situation involves a relation between several people and you yourself are in a position of initiative, you should examine the situation to see what is painful to you. Never mind the so-called ethics of the situation. Examine the situation to see what is painful to you and then do it. Because if you do it, you will in fact grow. Whereas if you don't do it, you'll become progressively more and more passive to the pleasure cycle. Which means to say that you're placing yourself in a position where you can be led by the nose by beings at a higher level. Now we have another more complicated question here. We'll have to be fairly careful about terms, I think, now. There appears to be a contradiction in certain of the characteristics we attribute to male and female. Of the male, we say that this represents A, the active principle, B, idea, C, form, etc. Of the female, passivity, formlessness, and will. Yet will we define as initiation, it is thus active, and idea as limitation, which would then be passive. How to resolve this apparent contradiction? There is a suggested answer to this. Is it that there is a continuous non-directional urge, potential will, in the passive field? Passive must not be considered to be without movement. Idea requires active limitation of will. The male directs and particularizes this urge. Now, when we've discussed paradox before, we've said that anything that exists necessarily contained within itself its opposite. We've said here the active principle male, and just write them down, and put the female on the sinister side of the field. So that's positive, that is negative, this is idea, this is will, idea is form. That's only the Greek for form, of course, but we'll put it down again. I'll make this into formlessness. Now, when we talk about will as initiative, we are talking, in using the word initiative, of a first occasion. By initiative, we mean the first occasion. And before that, whatever it is that comes to be at that moment did not exist. Let's imagine this translating force again, meandering about. There is no question yet of first, because first, by that T at the end, tells you there's at least a crossing. As soon as it crosses, then you have that letter T. As soon as it crosses also, in the fact of crossing, you have the possibility of islanding. So that when the first C circle comes to be, as soon as it's realized that, at the point of initiation, it is called will. At that very point, there must be a decision, a cutting off of that unformed, and it generates for itself a closure. Now that closure is a hole, and that hole will now draw over here. So the first thing to be initiated is an appetite, a hole. So we say the will here is that power which initiates. Behold, I make all things new. You can see this in the fact that the name of Jesus has an H in it, which is a feminine letter, and in Kabbalah you will find that this feminine letter has to do with the Messiah, because initiative is always the production of something which did not previously exist. And therefore it cannot be reckoned that there is a pre-existent form from which it started, and therefore it self is formless. So at the precise point where this turn occurs, see, before it closes, when it's turning round, which is formless, at the very moment that it touches, it has initiated the touch and is therefore will, and it has closed a zone. But the zone that it has closed is empty. And that emptiness now feels itself as empty. It now tries to draw into itself further energy. This drawing inness is the feminine aspect, the appetite aspect. What it is trying to draw in is energy to fulfill with form the zone it has created. Now it can drive in to the center, not to the dead center, but approximately towards it. Then it has to rotate and successively block by action, by rotation, the whole being. Right at the center there is a very hard core. Inside that hole, that is the immanent spirit. That does not rotate. Now this hard core now stands as a form inside an appetite. But you can see that that rotation there is itself a cycle, just like the big cycle outside it. We now see the meaning of hierarchy, because every circle that we draw has outside it another circle, and this infinite field of energy around it rotates, and the vibrations of the sphere impart this spherical rotation, and so we get a series of concentric spheres. Now each sphere is like an appetite to the one inside it. And each one inside is like a seed form, and is therefore male. So we could say that the perimeter circle is female, because it has drawn in, initiated this indrawing movement to make a form, and the form is masculine, idea, form, positive, is positive within it, and in so doing that female field has its consciousness heightened by the appearance of this closure within it. This is why in fact there is in the woman, as it says in Genesis, a desire towards the man. The woman shall desire the man, and the man shall rule over the woman. That is to say, the form, once it is inside, by its vibration must transmit the character of its vibration throughout the whole substantial appetite. Within that there is another form, masculine, relative to this outer one, and so on, right down to the very center, the yud point. Remember, we use the Hebrew letter yud, which is simply a dot, jot, yota, to symbolize that inner point. That is the supreme masculine. Round it is substance that is feminine to it.
that masculine to the substance outside, and this masculine to the substance outside there. Now, if you consider this very carefully, the bigger the circle, the longer the radius from there, the bigger the perimeter, the slower the vibration. The more we drive into the center, the shorter the perimeter, the shorter the radius, the faster the vibration. Now, the fast vibrations actually condition the modes of behavior of the slower ones. So the high frequency compression at the center is masculine and is positive, and it posits by its mode of activity to a limiting factor and turns on that factor and thus formulates an inner zone. Let's for a moment look at this. Here is the limits of our gross material body. That is substance. That body has to obey the internal forces of the body. There is your gross physical body, and inside that body is a body of feelings. Those feelings, likings and dislikings, cause the body to react in a certain way. Inside those feelings, by compression of them and the yes-no, there's a zone of ideas, and inside there a zone of spirit. The spirit is the primary closure, as we've represented it in the diagram of the wandering energy's first closure, which imposes by its rotation a spherical motion in infinity, and thus in effect dictates to infinity from that form. We see here that every being that exists is positive and negative in relation to another being, except the absolute top and the absolute bottom. The absolute top, the first letter of God's name, Jehovah, that Yod, represents the first compaction which imposes on the rest of the infinite energy, and the absolute bottom is the slowest vibration in the universe, the one we would call the gross mineral world. The absolute bottom, then, which is matter, is the meter principle, the mother principle, and the absolute top is the pater principle. And between these two arise all the degrees of relative positivity and negativity of beings. So inside ourselves we can say that when we feel this movement towards a new thing, before the actual establishment of the thing, what we are feeling is what we would call an urge, not yet formed. It is a want, and it is female. Remember, this is true of all human beings, because every man has a woman and every woman has a man inside. When we turn to find what we seek, at the moment of the turning and meeting, what we seek comes to be. But at the very moment it comes to be, we have created a zone of further appetite inside it. And we will be driven in searching for the next level of form. And we will drive in again for the next level of form, until finally we come to the Yud point, which is the level of the absolute. Now, as soon as we come into be as physical beings, material beings, we have started our first process. This is what St. Paul would call the physical body, first a physical body, and then later a spiritual body. The physical body of a child is acted upon by a stimulus, is drawn out, is formulated by that stimulus, and there then arises in it a consciousness, a heightened consciousness of pleasure in feeding, and later of pain in smacking, and so on. And then there will arise, through the formal impression, through that field, the nature of the character of the stimulus will impose ideas upon it, and then if it's very, very lucky, it will eventually evolve to the simple awareness that if it consciously puts its index finger into the situation instead of its thumb, it can formally initiate instead of simply initiating a motion. Remember that these definitions involve each other. We have to bear this in mind all the time. A series of concentric spheres, the outermost material one being passive to all the others, the innermost being positive, active towards all the others, and between the innermost and the outermost is the inner and the outer in varying degrees. Once we have come to be as material beings, the movement towards enhancement of life, towards more abundant life, is a movement towards inwardness, because it's only as we press inwards that we become progressively faster in our processes, that is, raise our frequencies, get higher frequencies, shorter waves, and thus are enabled by that fact to become quick. Remember, quickness, as defined by Christ, is this capacity in the consciousness to come to conclusions quicker than another fellow. The wave, which has a certain character, can be condensed, retain its character, but occupy less time. This occurs when you go inwardly in a positive act of introversion. In other words, you can perform a highly complex wave activity by effort of contraction driving onto your center in less time. When you can do this in less time than another man, you are relatively quick, and being quicker than he is, the situation is under your control. The fact that millions of beings exist all at different levels means that if a person actually wants to control the situation inside himself, he will have to release himself from the dictatorship of accidental motions from other beings. There is a hierarchy, there is a top level frequency, top level intelligence, where the decision and the will and the idea are simultaneous. Remember, the idea is a form. All form is circumscription. The circumscription itself is the forming, but leaves itself with a want on the inside. Right down here in the Pater center, the positive putting center, is the tiniest rotation there is, inside of which there is a want, a supreme want. That want is the cause of the efflux of initiative to the perimeter. This is the desire of God. The word desire, desire, means from the Father. God the Father operates through beings, and the beings at each level experience what is coming through them as a desire. And that desire, that is from the Father, from God the Father, experienced by them as a desire, is posited by him as a movement towards the perimeter. And therefore beings are extroverted from the center of initiative in themselves. There is a force inside every individual driving him into the external world, driving him into contingent relation, that is, into pain, because remember, the contingent relation is a relation in which you are bound to misunderstand the situation, and therefore bound to get into trouble, and in the process of that pain, bound to be led to think, and therefore bound ultimately to reach self-understanding. And all of this will arise from this positive center forcing the energy to the perimeter in all beings, and thus producing this contingent clash. Therefore, the more we can expose ourselves to this contingent relation, the more we suffer, the more quickly we will become informed about our true nature. When we have suffered enough for the sake of becoming self-aware, self-determinant, then we will understand just precisely what this hierarchy means. It is a device, as we said before, for enhancing life, because the simple undulating being was not of itself heightened in its awareness. It didn't even know that it knew, simply because it hadn't got any opposition. Opposition, then, says William Blake, is true friendship, and this opposition arises from the closure and the generation and these forces. Let's look at a little mechanical fact now from the science of music. If we get a rope, we nearly had one once and it was a bit stiff. We tie that rope to a post and then we give the rope a shake. Just lift it up like that. A hump will arrive on that rope. And that hump will travel progressively along the rope like this. And when it gets to the place where it is tied, because it is that way up, it cannot reflect back the same way. But as the thing condenses progressively onto the point of reflection, it is turned over and the loop now goes underneath. You can actually watch that if you get a long piece of rope. You can see, if you just slowly lift your hand up, this hump run along the rope, hit the post, turn underneath and go back. Now, if when you've started one motion going along, you start another one following it and keep it up, you will have a series of humps on the top, hitting the post and being reflected back like this. And the result will be automatically, in this fact, because the outgoing lengths must be the same as the ingoing ones, the production of nodes. And remember, node means not. Points of negation. Points of apparently no motion. Now, these nodes are the mechanical product of a simple waving of that line. Where there is a closure, represented in this case by the post. In our other diagram, the circular one, we start from the centre, initiate such a motion, and when it hits the perimeter, it comes back again and makes its nodes. Hence this powerful eighth letter, the H letter in the Egyptian hieroglyph. When these nodes come into being, they are points of ideation. Points of form. It implies the closure, not the simple ananda, which can go infinitely, but that same thing striking against a limit and therefore being forced to reflect, and thus making little islands, zones of warmth, in between which is always a node. Now let's look at this for a moment in a simplified manner. Every closure is a want and is female, and every node is male. That means to say that between every two wants there is a fulfilling node, and between every two nodes there is a want. This node is felt as terribly valuable by the spirit, and therefore it tends to generate round it a larger appetite to centre on that node. That node will then become a formative centre for the whole being. When we take this particular H diagram of the hieroglyph, and remember that it actually represents a man in his processes, in his three partners, we can see the use of these nodes. Now, we can imagine a cord lying down in the state symbolized by the Hindu pralaya, in pure passivity, in which it goes neither up nor down. It is doing nothing at all. And we call that the ultimate negation. It is passive to everything above it. And then we can see another way of producing this median line by causing rapid undulations to go right through it, and so timing them that they produce nodal points in contact with each other and all the nodes are on the same level, and yet we find a peculiar thing about it. Wherever there is a node, there is a motion going in one direction and in the opposite direction simultaneously. This means that every node is paradoxical, contains a yes and no in it. A motion is going through it, and a motion is returning through it. Now, if we take a cork and put that cork on the water and don't disturb the water, the cork will remain still. If we now disturb the water by hitting it or blowing on it, and imagine that a wave goes through and the trough appears, then the cork will sink. If we time our next blow on the surface of the water, we can cause that previous trough to have imposed upon it a crest. And thus, at the point where the cork is, the forces up and down will be equal, and the cork will stay on the median line, and apparently will not move. But the order of its non-motion is exactly opposite to the order of the non-motion in this pure passive. This means there are two kinds of stillness: the stillness of a corpse and the stillness of the king. In the stillness of the corpse, there is no motion there, and it is entirely passive. It is matter. It is the clay for the sculptor, for the model. But in the other order, where the motions of up and down are exactly balanced, simultaneously affirmed, there is a high degree of tension and awareness in that being. That being now has the top level activity. It is aware of the opposition in itself. And it says of Christ that he was all things to all men, and he knew what was in man, and therefore he didn't trust him. The reason was, he had gone through all the modes of motion and arrived at this paradoxical motion of simultaneous assertion of all opposites. And because he could feel this balance of powers in himself, this absolute intolerance and absolute tolerance simultaneously, unlike the merely passive man who feels nothing at all, he knew what that man felt, plus all the kinds of motion that could possibly disturb that man's passivity. So the apparent stillness of these two men is really exactly opposite. One is purely active and the other is purely passive. Now, in order to attain this paradoxical dialectical state, you have to affirm a pair of opposites simultaneously. And this brings us back to the first question about the yes and no again. In every situation, in all situations, there is something that we will not like. Quite definitely, that we will never like. Not that we will get to like if we practice, but that we will never like as finite beings. And this very, very thing we have to affirm as a value because we don't like it. And the very thing that we do like, we have to affirm as no value because we like it. If we remember what we've said in the threefold economy of the human being, if the urge towards pleasure is satisfied, the energy just turns back into the situation for more. And if it is satisfied again, it establishes a simple reflex cycle of pleasure pursuit. And as long as the pleasure is fulfilled, the energy will keep going into it. It will be like a kind of finite bliss. It would also be an abstract situation because it would ignore the fact that other beings exist. But if that pleasure pursuit comes against an obstacle which stops the pleasure, the energy turns in the other direction and goes into the head and becomes thought. Now, thought is a negation. It's a negation of the free will. And it's a negation that has to be affirmed, because the free will, that simple translation of infinity, is subjected to the first posited rotation, which has now become an irritant within it. When we think about situations, and gradually we become illuminated and see what it was that caused us to be trapped in the pleasure cycle. And we then discover that as long as we are trapped in a pleasure cycle, an external being can, by presenting the means to that pleasure, keep us in continual bondage. We've said before that the word people is, as a technical term, a very euphemistic word. Les gens, really the Gentiles, if you like, Gentiles. Those people who were concerned, or rather those beings who really deserve to be called people, are those who are concerned with a certain kind of activity of generation at the physical level. And this, we remember from our positive center affirming the perimeter, appears at the perimeter as pleasure in reproduction. And that merely provides bodies for experience. But the bodies through which those bodies are made are only steps in the evolutionary process. Those bodies are discarded right up to the time of reflexive self-consciousness in a descendant. To make one reflexive self-conscious person, thousands and thousands of generations have had to be sacrificed, because that self-reflection can only arise through a series of very painful situations. People, used technically, means those who provide, by reproductive activity, the organisms of experience which will ultimately, many generations, produce, by the piling up of negatives, of painful situations, a total awareness of all the form of the universe. When we become aware of this fact, that people as such are generators, that their sole function is the production of material organisms for spirit to evolve into, so that spirit may gain the experience and heighten its value by self-opposition, then we will decide, or we may decide, we don't have to, we may decide that we will stop being people in that sense. And we will decide that only when we have gained sufficient reflexive self-consciousness to constitute an end towards which people have been working. In fact, if there is a reflexive self-conscious man, it is quite legitimate for him to say, if he wants his neck breaking in public, to every person, "I am that towards which you have been striving." If he does say so, he may get into trouble by the law of reflex action. But he could say it. Precisely because he could say it, it is more likely that he would remember this other kind of passivity of the balance, crest, trough, and shut up, because of the necessary reaction at other levels. When we see that only in a closed situation can this propagating wave be reflected back and produce these nodes, and that these nodes are the forms we seek in order to become reflexively self-conscious by reflecting on them, then we will affirm every closed situation, knowing that the fact of that closure must cause the appearance in us of more nodes. So the person who says, like some gentleman on tonight, a lot of tramps who said that they had given up working because they didn't like being ordered about, and they were living in practically in the open, sort of corrugated tin tents. They had negated the idea of being ordered about, and they worked very, very slowly, and they were entirely passive to these other people whose orders they had refused. If they could have thought more carefully, they would realize that they were actually being conditioned by those people, because those people whose orders they had refused were building cities, bigger and bigger and bigger, and encroaching more and more and more upon the tips where they were living. So in rejecting the control in the harsh life of the city and moving away from it, all they had done was postpone the occasion when ultimately they would be found by a TV camera and forced into the public eye. Let's tie this up all together by saying that simply because when we wave that rope, if the other end of the rope is not tied to something, it cannot reflect back that motion, and if it doesn't reflect it back, it can't make these islands of appetite, that is, analyze the appetite, and it can't make these nodes, that is, these forms, which illuminate or sharpen or heighten the consciousness of that being. And then say that we will practice this, we will deliberately do our best to turn in every time a stimulus comes and examine our motive. Motive is the little motor that makes you run about. Look inside, and every time you find a tendency not to do it, then make yourself do it. Subject, of course, to the rule of the policeman's baton if the policeman is inside. Remember the great law we started with, that you are to go against your inclination except if doing the contrary would destroy the organism of your experience. That is, you are not to destroy your physical organism because you need it for generating more nodes. But apart from that, you must go against your inclinations. And remember that when you try to do this, you will find no inclination to do it. So that if you can do it, you will evidence that there is free will in you. Free will is not inclination. Remember that it's a vertical, as a good mason, an upright man, and true. And then that's the earth's surface for him. That's Peter crucified upside down. When a force acts upon him, it will either push him or it will hook him and try to pull him. Now, as soon as he feels it, if he goes out of the vertical, his body will incline. And that inclination of the body is only the objectification of the movement of the feeling self to try to assimilate that situation. And if he's disinclined, he is inclined away from the stimulus, and it means he feels he could not assimilate it. We have to remember that we can assimilate anything whatever if we will to. If we gather ourselves together, there is nothing that we cannot assimilate. And we shouldn't be afraid of having to assimilate things like heavy rollers rolled over us, because if we are not afraid of it, we are not likely to attract rollers to roll over us right up till the last day when we should be buried in any case. There's a hierarchy of tests. We will never be tested if we are sincere within ourselves more than we can assimilate. We are not over-tried, ever. We are only tried at the level at which we could respond adequately. And if we are afraid, the scattering of motions inside us does not evidence that we are not equipped to deal with the situation. It is merely the product of suggestions from other beings who have failed, or the memories of previous failures inside ourselves that would condition our response. But in every concrete situation in which we find ourselves, we are always internally equipped to deal with it, and therefore we should drive ourselves into the most limiting situations we can, remembering that when we drive ourselves into a limiting situation, there will be rapid reflection from the limit, and the tighter the situation, the quicker the reflection occurs, the higher the frequency, the faster the mental process, You know this empirically. If you've ever been in a tight spot, like suddenly waking up to a reality of a situation,
different speeds of different centres, is that the same idea?
Yes.
Those concentric circles. Mm. You see, when you take a sensation, contact is the type of it, material hammering, that's the slowest frequency there is. When you go inside yourself, you're actually elevating your awareness at higher frequencies. You're becoming more conscious. The nearer you get to your center, the higher the frequency, the quicker your response. You can prove this to yourself, because when you try to get into your center, you will find that the nearer to the center you get, the harder it is. And that hardness is the evidence of the energy compaction inside you. And when energy is compacting, it is changing its phase into a higher frequency. And therefore, the more you compact yourself in that way, the less passive to other beings you will be. You take a hard school, like, say, the harm school, training the world rulers for the period after the next war. Now, hammering those people up the mountains and over the rivers and everywhere, physically, anywhere at all that they feel disinclined to go. Physically and rationally, where you've got an idea that you cherish, give it up. If you've got one that you don't want to examine, examine it. Emotionally, if you don't like something, make yourself go into it. If you do like it, drive yourself away from it. This is the only way that you can compact yourself. So the whole thing is contained in this self-mastery idea. It's yourself using yourself that has to conquer yourself. You are a certain amount of intelligent force. You can only persuade this force to change its phase by restricting it, never by indulging it. If you let it loose and go out and let it slop over somebody else's dining table, they'll remove the table or you. But if you can draw yourself in, the tighter you become, nature abhorring a vacuum, the people out there will want to do something about it. They must reduce the distance, because you have actually created a vacuum in the spiritual sense, and they start abhorring it. So they must come towards you if you do the work. And if you don't fly, you'll be very, very busy. But if you do fly for a negative reason, you'll start relaxing again, then nobody will want to see you. And the important thing is to realize that there are hierarchies of beings way over man as he is today. Not way over man in his human sense. Human is more than man in this sense. Human is spiritualized man. Whereas man is merely a counter in the empirical sense. To get these higher values, you can only get them the way evolution has gone. It started as a splurge, a bit of spineless protoplasm. Like an amoeba, it just spreads out to get its tint in. But you've got to bring it in. Through trying to bring in that protoplasm, the vertebrates appeared. The spine is simply a wheel condensing itself and packing this calcium into those centers. And when the skeleton had been formed, it became possible for that jelly to stand up. But only by this process of compaction, which is not self-indulgence. All the soft parts of the body, the lower parts and forward parts, are as primitive today as the worm is primitive in the ground. The intestine is a worm. It hasn't got a higher intelligence level than a worm in the ground. So if you actually center yourself in that, you will start indulging yourself. And if you move backwards deliberately into the spine and move upwards, backwards and upwards, hemophobats and introverts, you go upwards, then in the fact of drawing yourself into the spine, you're drawing yourself into a center that has been precipitated by hard compaction, and the frequencies in there are higher
than they are in this self-indulgent part. And therefore you're actually increasing your control. But remember that the worm part in you, the intestinal worm, doesn't want you to do it. It wants to enjoy itself. So it resents you being reasonable. It tries to stop you. You feel depressed in the stomach. That's the head of the cobra. So it spits out rude remarks. Remember, your tongue is simply an outgrowth of the gullet, just a thin end of the wedge. And if you can, as the Bible says, if you can control the tongue, you can control the whole organism. Simply because the only thing you've got to control is that primal will. That will is will to indulge itself. So the negation of the will from outside, it has been forced to think. But it has rejected the thoughts, pushed them up out of the way. It doesn't want to listen to them. So it's pushed them to the other end of the beam. It's pushed them into here. And the force pushing them out has produced the skull. The limit, the hard limit to which it is pushing. And the brain has replied by compacting in the body a rod of office in the spine. So there's a continuous fight going on where the belly worm throws away all thoughts of reason, and all it can do is push them to the other end of the organism, so they get stored in the head, and the head replies by centrifuging them and spinning them out. And that spinning out lays the spinal column as a rod, penetrating back into the worm line. So there's this dialectical opposition between your self-indulgence and your rigid principle. And every being has these two inside itself. And if it does not resolve this conflict, it will be eternally dissatisfied. Because the dissolution of the gross material body just leaves us as we were at the moment of that dissolution. If we haven't resolved the opposition between our principle and our self-indulgence, we'll simply be in this unresolved state after death of being in conflict with ourselves. So we have to affirm the negative that the worm has rejected. Take the principle that's been rejected. This is the stone rejected by the builder down here. He's building his Xanadu palace where his pleasures will be had. This is a pleasure dome down here. And we have to penetrate down to their centers and issue orders and know that they won't like it. If we think that the stomach will like an order of self-control, it's a misunderstanding of the stomach. The only way you can convert the stomach is to say, someday, when you have behaved yourself according to principle, you will have such a joy that you could never have had such a joy without this control. And it will never believe you. Like Omar, it says, take the cash in hand and wave the rest. In saying yes to paint this situation. Anybody would like to volunteer? I will guarantee to provide some paint for situation. You have to. I can. Little box of accelerators.
The most painful situation I've ever been in is right after undifferentiation between mind. It's not the swings.
Yes, it is. Wonderful, isn't it? Isn't it a pity you can only experience that once?
I'm sorry, I don't understand that.
Well, you've only been undifferentiated once. After that, all you're doing is remembering that indifferentiation within a field of differentiation. That's why you feel so awful about it. Because you know you'll have to come back in the end. The other day, a schizophrenic man who felt himself to become ambivalent and said so then and there, suddenly said he felt it was illegitimate to do this. It was wrong of him to do it. He felt that everything was perfectly all right. Everything was transparent. And every person was fundamentally free if they knew it. And that he knew it and they didn't. And he felt this was cheating. But the real thing was, he was cheating himself. Because he knew he hadn't got that indifferentiation anymore. It was only a vague something, far back in infinity. What he had now was a fact of differentiation and a desire to get rid of what he'd got. So all he did was repress the reason in him for the time being and have an escape by simply compressing out of consciousness the form that he had. And then as soon as his energy died down, the repressed knowledge, reason, sprang out again and depressed him. You can only be undifferentiated once, and then you're stuck in all eternity with the problem of how to integrate yourself properly, which you can never do by dodging. You see, it's a pipe dream. It's a pretense to say that you experience nirvana, that state of indifferentiation. You don't. You can never unbecome your being. And the Bhagavad Gita says that which is can never cease to be. This is what it is talking about. Once you've discovered yourself, you know that you can never deceive yourself into thinking that you are merely nothing, blissfully going along. You're a being, self-deceiving, pretending you're not a being but a floating miasma. And it won't do, because ultimately you've got to come back to yourself.